anyone but him, perhaps not even to her. But where he used to come into the apartment and see her sketching at the table, and the two of them were able to talk, companionably, as he drank a glass of water and looked at her drawings, she would now just nod at him and say, "Willem's at the store," or, "He's coming back soon," even though he hadn't asked. She was always welcome at Lispenard Street, whether Willem was there or not, and he would linger a bit until it was clear she didn't want to speak, and then retreat to his room to work. He understood why Philippa might resent him. Willem invited him everywhere with them, included him in everything, even in their retirement, even in Philippa's daydream of their old age. After that, he was careful to always decline Willem's invitations, even if it was to things that didn't involve his and Philippa's couplehood. If they were going to a party at Malcolm's, to which he was also invited, he'd leave separately. And at Thanksgiving, he made sure to ask Philippa to Boston as well, though she hadn't come in the end. He had even tried to talk to Willem about what he sensed, to awaken him to what he was certain she was feeling. "Do you not like her?" Willem had asked him, concerned. "You know I like Philippa," he'd replied. "But I think you should just hang out with her more alone, Willem, with just the two of you. It must get annoying for her to always have me around." "Did she say that to you?" "No, Willem, of course not. I'm just guessing. From my vast experience with women, you know." Later, when Willem and Philippa broke up, he would feel as guilty as if he had been solely to blame. But even before that, he had wondered whether Willem, too, had come to realize that no serious girlfriend would tolerate his constant presence in Willem's life. He wondered whether Willem was trying to make alternative plans for him, so he didn't end up living in a cottage on the property he'd someday have with his wife, so he wouldn't be Willem's sad bachelor friend, a useless reminder of his forsaken, childish life. "I will be alone," he decided. He wouldn't be the one to ruin Willem's chances for happiness. He wanted Willem to have the orchard and the termite-nibbled house and the grandchildren and the wife who was jealous of his company and attention. He wanted Willem to have everything he deserved, everything he desired. He wanted every day of his life to be free of worries and obligations and responsibilities, even if that worry and obligation and responsibility was him. The following week, Richard's father, a tall, smiling, pleasant man he'd met at Richard's first show 3 years ago, sent him the contract, which he had a law school classmate, a real estate lawyer, review in tandem with him, and the building's engineering report, which he gave to Malcolm. The price had almost nauseated him, but his classmate said he had to do it. "This is an unbelievable deal, Jude. You will never, never, never find something that size in that neighborhood for this amount of money." And after reviewing the report, and then the space, Malcolm told him the same thing. "Buy it." So he did. And although he and the Goldfarbs had worked out a leisurely 10-year payment schedule, an interest-free rent-to-own plan, he was determined to pay the apartment off as soon as he could. Every 2 weeks, he allotted half of his paycheck to the apartment and the other half to his savings and living expenses. He told Harold he had moved during their weekly phone call. "Thank Christ," Harold said. He had never liked Lispenard Street, but didn't tell him he had bought a place because he didn't want Harold to feel obligated to offer him money for it. From Lispenard Street, he brought only his mattress and lamp and the table and a chair, all of which he arranged into one corner of the space. At nights, he would sometimes look up from his work and think what a ludicrous decision this had been. How could he ever fill so much room? How would it ever feel like his? He was reminded of Boston, of Hereford Street, and how there he had dreamed only of a bedroom, of a door he might someday close. Even when he was in Washington clerking for Sullivan, he had slept in the living room of a one-bedroom apartment he shared with a legislative assistant whom he rarely saw. Lispenard Street had been the first time in his life that he'd had a room, a real room with a real window, wholly to himself. But a year after he moved into Green Street, Malcolm installed the walls, and the place began to feel a little more comfortable, and the year after that, Willem moved in, and it felt more comfortable still. He saw less of Richard than he thought he might. They were both traveling frequently, but on Sunday evenings he would sometimes go down to his studio and help him with one of his projects, polishing a bunch of small branches smooth with a leaf of sandpaper, or snipping the rachis off the vane from a fluff of peacock feathers. Richard's studio was the sort of place he would have loved as a child. Everywhere were containers and bowls of marvelous things. Twigs and stones and dried beetles and feathers and tiny, bright-hued, taxidermied birds and blocks in various shapes made of some soft, pale wood. And at times he wished he could be allowed to abandon his work and simply sit on the floor and play, which he had usually been too busy to do as a boy. By the end of the third year, he had paid for the apartment and had immediately begun saving for the renovation. This took less time than he'd thought it would, in part because of something that had happened with Andy. He'd gone uptown one day for his appointment, and Andy had walked in, looking grim and yet oddly triumphant. "What?" he'd asked. And Andy had silently handed him a magazine article he'd sliced out of a journal. He read it. It was an academic report about how a recently developed semi-experimental laser surgery that had held great promise as a solution for damageless keloid removal was now proven to have adverse medium-term effects. Although the keloids were eliminated, patients instead developed raw, burn-like wounds, and the skin beneath the scars became significantly more fragile, more susceptible to splitting and cracking, which resulted in blisters and infection. "This is what you're thinking of doing, isn't it?" Andy asked him, as he sat holding the pages in his hand, unable to speak. "I know you, Judy, and I know you made an appointment at that quack Thompson's office. Don't deny it. They called for your chart. I didn't send it. Please don't do this, Jude. I'm serious. The last thing you need are open wounds on your back as well as your legs." And then when he didn't say anything, "Talk to me." He shook his head. Andy was right. He had been saving for this as well. Like his annual bonuses and most of his savings, all the money he'd made long ago from tutoring Felix had been given over to the apartment. But in recent months, as it was clear he was closing in on his final payments, he had begun saving anew for the surgery. He had it all worked out. He'd have the surgery, and then he'd finish saving for the renovation. He had visions of it, his back made as smooth as the floors themselves, the thick, unbudgeable worm trail of scars vaporized in seconds, and with it, all evidence of his time in the home and in Philadelphia, the documentation of those years erased from his body. He tried so hard to forget. He tried every day. But as much as he tried, there it was to remind him, proof that what he pretended hadn't happened actually had. "Jude," Andy said, sitting next to him on the examining table, "I know you're disappointed, and I promise you that when there's a treatment available that's both effective and safe, I'll let you know. I know it bothers you. I'm always looking out for something for you. But right now there isn't anything, and I can't in good conscience let you do this to yourself." He was quiet. They both were. "I suppose I should have asked you this more frequently, Jude, but do they hurt you? Do they cause you any discomfort? Does the skin feel tight?" He nodded. "Look, Jude," Andy said after a pause, "there are some creams I can give you that'll help with that, but you're going to need someone to help massage them in nightly, or it's not going to be effective. Would you let someone do this for you? Willem? Richard?" "I can't," he said, speaking to the magazine article in his hands. "Well," said Andy, "I'll write you a script anyway, and I'll show you how to do it. Don't worry, I asked an actual dermatologist. This isn't some method I've made up, but I can't say how efficacious it's going to be on your own." He slid off the table. "Will you open your gown for me and turn toward the wall?" He did, and felt Andy's hands on his shoulders and then moving slowly across his back. He thought Andy might say, as he sometimes did, It's not so bad, Jude. Or, you don't have anything to be self-conscious about. But this time he didn't. Just trailed his hands across him, as if his palms were themselves lasers, something that was hovering over him and healing him, the skin beneath them turning healthy and unmarked. Finally, Andy told him he could cover himself again, and he did, and turned back around. "I'm really sorry, Jude," Andy said. And this time, it was Andy who couldn't look at him. "Do you want to grab something to eat?" Andy asked after the appointment was over, as he was putting his clothes back on, but he shook his head. "I should go back to the office." Andy was quiet then, but as he was leaving, he stopped him. "Jude," he said, "I really am sorry. I don't like being the one who has to destroy your hopes." He nodded. He knew Andy didn't. But in that moment, he couldn't stand being around him and wanted only to get away. However, he reminds himself, he is determined to be more realistic, to stop thinking he can make himself better. The fact that he can't get this surgery means he now has the money for Malcolm to begin the renovation in earnest. Over the years he has owned the apartment, he has witnessed Malcolm grow both bolder and more imaginative in his work, and so the plans he drew when he first bought the place have been changed and revised and improved upon multiple times. In them he can see the development of what even he can recognize as an aesthetic confidence, a self-assured idiosyncrasy. Shortly before he began working at Rosen, Pritchard, and Klein, Malcolm had quit his job at Ratstar, and with two of his former colleagues and Sophie, an acquaintance of his from architecture school, had founded a firm called Bellcast. Their first commission had been the renovation of the pied-à-terre of one of Malcolm's parents' friends. Bellcast did mostly residential work, but last year they had been awarded their first significant public commission for a photography museum in Doha, and Malcolm, like Willem, like himself, was absent from the city more and more frequently. "Never underestimate the importance of having rich parents, I guess," some asshole at one of JB's parties had grumbled, sourly, when he heard that Bellcast had been the runners-up in a competition to design a memorial in Los Angeles for Japanese Americans who had been interned in the war, and JB had started shouting at him before he and Willem had a chance. The two of them had smiled at each other over JB's head, proud of him for defending Malcolm so vehemently. And so he has watched as, with each new revised blueprint for Green Street, hallways have materialized and then vanished, and the kitchen has grown larger and then smaller, and bookcases have gone from stretching along the northern wall, which has no windows, to the southern wall, which does, and then back again. One of the renderings eliminated walls altogether. "It's a loft, Judy, and you should respect its integrity," Malcolm had argued with him, but he had been firm. He needed a bedroom. He needed a door he could close and lock. And in another, Malcolm had tried to block up the southern-facing windows entirely, which had been the reason he had chosen the sixth-floor unit to begin with, and which Malcolm later admitted had been an idiotic idea. But he enjoys watching Malcolm work, is touched that he has spent so much time, more than he himself has, thinking about how he might live. And now it is going to happen. Now he has enough saved for Malcolm to indulge even his most outlandish design fantasies. Now he has enough for every piece of furniture Malcolm has ever suggested he might get, for every carpet and vase. These days he argues with Malcolm about his most recent plans. The last time they reviewed the sketches, 3 months ago, he had noticed an element around the toilet in the master bathroom that he couldn't identify. "What's that?" he'd asked Malcolm. "Grab bars," Malcolm said, briskly, as if by saying it quickly it would become less significant. "Judy, I know what you're going to say, but—" But he was already examining the blueprints more closely, peering at Malcolm's tiny notations in the bathroom, where he'd added steel bars in the shower and around the bathtub as well, and in the kitchen, where he'd lowered the height of some of the countertops. "But I'm not even in a wheelchair," he'd said, dismayed. "But Jude," Malcolm had begun, and then stopped. He knew what Malcolm wanted to say. But you have been, and you will be again. But he didn't. These are standard ADA guidelines, he said instead. Mal, he'd said, chagrined by how upset he was. I understand, but I don't want this to be some cripple's apartment. It won't be, Jude, it'll be yours. But don't you think maybe, just as a precaution— No, Malcolm. Get rid of them. I mean it. But don't you think, just as a matter of practicality— Now you're interested in practicalities? The man who wanted me to live in a 5,000-square-foot space with no walls? He stopped. I'm sorry, Mal. It's okay, Jude, Malcolm said. I understand. I do. Now Malcolm stands before him, grinning. I have something to show you, he says, waving the baton of a rolled-up paper in his hand. Malcolm, thank you, he says, but should we look at them later? He'd had to schedule an appointment with the tailor. He doesn't want to be late. It'll be fast, Malcolm says, and I'll leave them with you. He sits next to him and smooths out the sheaf of pages, giving him one end to hold, explaining things he's changed and tweaked. Counters back up to standard height, says Malcolm, pointing at the kitchen. No grab bars in the shower area, but I gave you this ledge that you can use as a seat just in case. I swear it'll look nice. I kept the ones around the toilet. Just think about it, okay? We'll install them last, and if you really, really hate them, we'll leave them off, but I'd do it, Judy. He nods, reluctantly. He won't know it then, but years later, he will be grateful that Malcolm has prepared for his future, even when he hadn't wanted to. He will notice that in his apartment, the passages are wider, that the bathroom and kitchen are oversized, so a wheelchair can make a full, clean revolution in them, that the doorways are generous, that wherever possible, the doors slide instead of swing, that there is no cabinetry under the master bathroom sink, that the highest-placed closet rods lower with the touch of a pneumatic button, that there is a bench-like seat in the bathtub, and, finally, that Malcolm won the fight about the grab bars around the toilet. He'll feel a sort of bitter wonderment that yet another person in his life, Andy, Willem, Richard, and now Malcolm, had foreseen his future and knew how inevitable it was. After their appointment, where Malcolm is measured for a navy suit and a dark gray one, and where Franklin, the tailor, greets him and asks why he hasn't seen him for 2 years, I'm pretty sure that's my fault, Malcolm says, smiling. They have lunch. It's nice taking a Saturday off, he thinks, as they drink rosewater lemonade and eat za'atar-dusted roasted cauliflower at the crowded Israeli restaurant near Franklin's shop. Malcolm is excited to start work on the apartment, and he is, too. This is such perfect timing, Malcolm keeps saying. I'll have the office submit everything to the city on Monday, and by the time it's approved, I'll be done with Doha and be able to get started right away, and you can move into Willem's while it's being done. Malcolm has just finished the final pieces of work on Willem's apartment, which he has supervised more of than Willem has. By the end of the process, he was making decisions for Willem on paint colors. Malcolm did a beautiful job, he thinks. He won't mind at all staying there for the next year. It is early when they finish lunch. They linger on the sidewalk outside. For the past week it's been raining, but today the skies are blue, and he is still feeling strong, even a little restless, and he asks Malcolm if he wants to walk for a bit. He can see Malcolm hesitate, flicking his gaze up and down his body as if trying to determine how capable he is, but then he smiles and agrees, and the two of them start heading west and then north toward the village. They pass the building on Mulberry Street that J.B. used to live in before he moved farther east, and they are quiet for a minute, both of them, he knows, thinking about J.B. and wondering what he's doing, and knowing but also not knowing why he hasn't answered their and Willem's calls, their texts, their emails. The three of them have had dozens of conversations with one another, with Richard, with Ali, and the Henry Youngs about what to do. But with every attempt they have made to find J.B., he has eluded them, or barred their way, or ignored them. We just have to wait until it gets worse, Richard had said at one point, and he fears that Richard is correct. It is sometimes as if J.B. is no longer theirs at all, and they can do nothing but wait for the moment in which he will have a crisis only they can solve, and they will be able to parachute into his life once again.
Okay, Malcolm, I've got to ask you, he says, as they walk up the stretch of Hudson Street that is deserted on the weekends, its sidewalks treeless and empty of people. Are you getting married to Sophie or not? We all want to know.
God, Jude, I just don't know,
Malcolm begins, but he sounds relieved, as if he's been waiting to be asked the question all along. Maybe he has. He lists the potential negatives. Marriage is so conventional, it feels so permanent, he's not really interested in the idea of a wedding, but fears Sophie is, his parents are going to try to get involved, something about spending the rest of his life with another architect depresses him, he and Sophie are co-founders of the firm, if something happens between them, what will happen to Belcast? And the positives, which also sound like negatives. If he doesn't propose, he thinks Sophie will leave. His parents have been bothering him about it nonstop, and he'd like them to shut up. He really does love Sophie, and knows he won't be able to do better than her. He's 38, and feels he has to do something. As he listens to Malcolm, he tries not to smile. He has always liked this about Malcolm, how he can be so decisive on the page and in his designs, and yet in the rest of his life so in a dither and so unself-conscious about sharing it. Malcolm has never been someone who pretended he was cooler or more confident or silkier than he actually is, and as they grow older, he appreciates and admires more and more his sweet guilelessness, his complete trust in his friends and their opinions.
What do you think, Jude? Malcolm asks at last. I've actually really wanted to talk to you about this. Should we sit down somewhere? Do you have time? I know Willem's on his way back home.
He could be more like Malcolm, he thinks. He could ask his friends for help. He could be vulnerable around them. He has been before, after all. It just hasn't been by choice. But they have always been kind to him. They have never tried to make him feel self-conscious. Shouldn't that teach him something? Maybe, for instance, he will ask Willem if he could help him with his back. If Willem is disgusted by his appearance, he'll never say anything. And Andy was right. It is too difficult to apply the creams by himself, and eventually he stopped, although he didn't throw any of them away either. He tries to think how he might begin the conversation with Willem, but he finds he can't move beyond the first word, Willem, even in his imaginings. And in that moment, he knows he won't be able to ask Willem after all.
Not because I don't trust you, he says to Willem,
with whom he will never have this conversation,
but because I can't bear to have you see me as I really am.
Now, when he imagines himself as an old man, he is still alone, but on Green Street, and in these wanderings he sees Willem in a house somewhere green and tree-filled, the Adirondacks, the Berkshires, and Willem is happy. He is surrounded by people who love him, and maybe a few times a year he comes into the city to visit him on Green Street, and they spend the afternoon together. In these dreams, he is always sitting down, so he's uncertain if he can still walk or not, but he knows that he is delighted to see Willem, always, and that at the end of all their meetings, he is able to tell him not to worry, that he can take care of himself, giving him that assurance like a benediction, pleased that he has had the strength to not spoil Willem's idol with his needs, his loneliness, his wants. But that, he reminds himself, is many years in the future. Right now there is Malcolm, and his hopeful, anxious face, waiting to hear his reply.
He's not back until this evening, he tells Malcolm. We've got all afternoon, Mal. I've got as much time as you need.
Chapter 3.
The last time J.B. tried, really tried, to stop doing drugs, it was 4th of July weekend. No one else was in the city. Malcolm was with Sophie visiting her parents in Hamburg.
Jude was with Harold and Julia in Copenhagen. Willem was shooting in Cappadocia. Richard was in Wyoming, at an artist's colony. Asian Henry Young was in Reykjavik. Only he remained, and if he hadn't been so determined, he wouldn't have been in town either. He'd have been in Beacon, where Richard had a house, or in Quag, where Ezra had a house, or in Woodstock, where Ali had a house, or, well, there weren't that many other people who would give him their house nowadays, and besides, he wasn't talking to most of them because they were getting on his nerves. But he hated summer in New York. All fat people hated summer in New York. Everything was always sticking to everything else, flesh to flesh, flesh to fabric. You never felt truly dry. And yet there he was, unlocking the door of his studio on the third floor of the white brick building in Kensington, glancing involuntarily toward the end of the hall, where Jackson's studio was, before he let himself in. J.B. was not an addict. Yes, he did drugs. Yes, he did a lot of them. But he wasn't an addict. Other people were addicts. Jackson was an addict. So was Zane. And so was Hera. Massimo and Topher? Also addicts. Sometimes it felt like he was the only one who hadn't slipped over the edge. And yet he knew that a lot of people thought he had, which is why he was still in the city when he should be in the country. 4 days, no drugs, only work. And then no one would be able to say anything ever again. Today, Friday, was day one. The air conditioning unit in his studio was broken, so the first thing he did was open all the windows, and then, once he had knocked, lightly on Jackson's door to make sure he wasn't inside, the door as well. Normally, he never opened the door, both because of Jackson and because of the noise. His studio was one of 14 rooms on the third floor of a 5-story building. The rooms were meant to be used only as studio space, but he guessed about 20% of the building's occupants actually lived there illegally. On the rare occasions he had arrived at his studio before 10 in the morning, he would see people shuffling through the corridors in their boxers, and when he went to the bathroom at the end of the hall, there'd be someone in there taking a sponge bath in the sink, or shaving or brushing his teeth, and he'd nod at them, "What's up, man?" And they'd nod back. Sadly, however, the overall effect was less collegiate and more institutional. This depressed him. J.B. could have found studio space elsewhere, better, more private studio space, but he'd taken this one because, he was embarrassed to admit, the building looked like a dormitory, and he hoped it might feel like college again. But it didn't. The building was also supposed to be a low-noise-density site, whatever that meant, but along with the artists, a number of bands, ironic thrasher bands, ironic folk bands, ironic acoustic bands, had also rented studios there, which meant that the hallway was always jumbled with noise, all of the band's instruments melding together to make one long whine of guitar feedback. The bands weren't supposed to be there, and once every few months, when the owner of the building, a Mr. Chen, stopped by for a surprise inspection, he would hear the shouts bouncing through the hallways, even through his closed door, each person's call of alarm echoed by the next until the warning had saturated all 5 floors. Chen! 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 So by the time Mr. Chen stepped inside the front door, all was quiet, so unnaturally quiet that he imagined he could hear his next-door neighbor grinding his inks against his whetstone, and his other neighbor's spirograph scritching against canvas. And then Mr. Chen would get into his car and drive away, and the echoes would reverse themselves. Clear! 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 And the cacophony would rise up again, like a flock of screeching cicadas. Once he was certain he was alone on the floor. God, where was everyone? Was he truly the last person left on Earth? He took off his shirt, and then after a moment, his pants, and began cleaning his studio, which he hadn't done in months. Back and forth he walked to the trash cans near the service elevator, stuffing them full of old pizza boxes and empty beer cans and scraps of paper with doodles on them and brushes whose bristles had gone straw-like because he hadn't cleaned them, and pallets of watercolors that had turned to clay because he hadn't kept them moist. Cleaning was boring. It was particularly boring while sober. He reflected, as he sometimes did, that none of the supposedly good things that were supposed to happen to you when you were on meth had happened to him. Other people he knew had grown gaunt, or had non-stop anonymous sex, or had binges in which they cleaned or organized their apartments or studios for hours. But he remained fat. His sex drive had vanished. His studio and apartment remained disasters. True, he was working remarkably long stretches, 12-14 hours at a time, but he couldn't attribute that to the meth. He had always been a hard worker. When it came to painting or drawing, he had always had a long attention span. After an hour or so of picking things up, the studio looked exactly the same as it had when he began, and he was craving a cigarette, which he didn't have, or a drink, which he also didn't have, and shouldn't have anyway, as it was still only noon. He knew he had a ball of gum in his jeans pocket, which he dug around for and found. It was slightly damp from the heat, and stuffed it into his mouth, chewing it as he lay supine, his eyes closed, the cement floor cool beneath his back and thighs, pretending he was elsewhere, not in Brooklyn in July in the 90-degree heat. "How am I feeling?" he asked himself. "Okay," he answered himself. The shrink he had started seeing had told him to ask himself that. "It's like a sound check," he'd said. "Just a way to check in with yourself. How am I feeling? Do I want to use? If I do want to use, why do I want to use? It's a way for you to communicate with yourself, to examine your impulses instead of simply giving in to them." What a moron, J.B. had thought. He still thought this. And yet, like many moronic things, he was unable to expunge the question from his memory. Now, at odd, unwelcome moments, he would find himself asking himself how he felt. Sometimes the answer was, like I want to do drugs, and so he'd do them, if only to illustrate to his therapist just how moronic his method was. "See," he'd say to Giles in his head, Giles, who wasn't even a PhD, just an MSW. "So much for your self-examination theory." "What else, Giles? What's next?" Seeing Giles had not been JB's idea. 6 months ago, in January, his mother and aunts had had a mini-intervention with him, which had begun with his mother sharing memories of what a bright and precocious boy JB had been, and look at him now. And then his Aunt Christine, literally playing bad cop, yelling at him about how he was wasting all the opportunities that her sister had provided him and how he had become a huge pain in the ass, and then his Aunt Sylvia, who had always been the gentlest of the three, reminding him that he was so talented and that they all wanted him back, and wouldn't he consider getting treatment? He had not been in the mood for an intervention, even one as low-key and cozy as theirs had been. His mother had provided his favorite cheesecake, which they all ate, as they discussed his flaws, because, among other things, he was still angry at them. The month before, his grandmother had died, and his mother had taken a whole day to call him. She claimed it was because she couldn't find him and he wasn't picking up his phone, but he knew that the day she had died he had been sober, and his phone had been on all day, and so he wasn't sure why his mother was lying to him.
"J.B., Grandma would have been heartbroken if she knew what you've become," his mother said to him. "God, Ma, just fuck off," he'd said, wearily, sick of her wailing and quivering, and Christine had popped up and slapped him across the face. After that, he'd agreed to go see Giles, some friend of a friend of Sylvia's, as a way of apologizing to Christine, and, of course, to his mother. Unfortunately, Giles truly was an idiot, and during their sessions, paid for by his mother, he wasn't going to waste his money on therapy, especially bad therapy, he would answer Giles's uninventive questions. "Why do you think you're so attracted to drugs, JB? What do you feel they give you? Why do you think your use of them has accelerated so much over the past few years? Why do you think you're not talking to Malcolm and Jude and Willem as much?" with answers he knew would excite him. He would slip in mentions of his dead father, of the great emptiness and sense of loss his absence had inspired in him, of the shallowness of the art world,
of his fears that he would never fulfill his promise, and watch Giles's pen bob ecstatically over his pad, and feel both disdain for stupid Giles as well as disgust for his own immaturity. Fucking with one's therapist, even if one's therapist truly deserved to be fucked with, was the sort of thing you did when you were 19, not when you were 39. But although Giles was an idiot, JB did find himself thinking about his questions, because they were questions that he had asked himself as well. And although Giles had posed each as a discrete quandary, he knew that in reality, each one was inseparable from the last, and that if it had been grammatically and linguistically possible to ask all of them together in one big question, then that would be the truest expression of why he was where he was. First, he'd say to Giles, he hadn't set out to like drugs as much as he did. That sounded like an obvious and even silly thing to say, but the truth was that JB knew people, mostly rich, mostly white, mostly boring, mostly unloved by their parents, who had in fact started taking drugs because they thought it might make them more interesting, or more frightening, or more commanding of attention, or simply because it made the time go faster. His friend Jackson, for example, was one of those people, but he was not. Of course, he had always done drugs, everyone had, but in college and in his 20s, he had thought of drugs the way he thought of desserts, which he also loved, a consumable that had been forbidden to him as a child and which was now freely available. Doing drugs, like having post-dinner snacks of cereal so throat-singingly sweet that the leftover milk in the bowl could be slurped down like sugarcane juice, was a privilege of adulthood, one he intended to enjoy. Questions 2 and 3. When and why had drugs become so important to him? He knew the answers to those as well. When he was 32, he'd had his first show. Two things had happened after that show. The first was that he had become, genuinely, a star. There were articles written about him in the art press, and articles written about him in magazines and newspapers read by people who wouldn't know their Sue Williams from their Sue Coe. And the second was that his friendship with Jude and Willem had been ruined. Perhaps ruined was too strong a word, but it had changed. He had done something bad, he could admit it. And Willem had taken Jude's side, and why should he have been surprised at all that Willem had taken Jude's side, because really, when he reviewed their entire friendship, there was the evidence. Time after time after time of Willem always taking Jude's side, and although they both said they forgave him, something had shifted in their relationship. The two of them, Jude and Willem, had become their own unit, united against everyone, united against him. Why had he never seen this before? We two form a multitude. And yet he had always thought that he and Willem had been a unit. But all right, they weren't. So who was he left with? Not Malcolm, because Malcolm had eventually started dating Sophie, and they made their own unit. And so who would be his partner? Who would make his unit? No one, it often seemed. They had abandoned him. And then, with each year, they abandoned him further. He had always known he would be the first among the four of them to be a success. This wasn't arrogance, he just knew it. He worked harder than Malcolm, he was more ambitious than Willem. He didn't count Jude in this race, as Jude's profession was one that operated on an entirely different set of metrics, one that didn't much matter to him. He was prepared to be the rich one, or the famous one, or the respected one, and he knew, even as he was dreaming about his riches and fame and respect, that he would remain friends with all of them, that he would never forsake them for anyone else, no matter how overwhelming the temptation might be. He loved them. They were his. But he hadn't counted on them abandoning him, on them outgrowing him through their own accomplishments. Malcolm had his own business. Jude was doing whatever he did impressively enough so that when he was representing JB in a silly argument he'd had the previous spring with a collector he was trying to sue to reclaim an early painting that the collector had promised he could buy back and then reneged on,
The collector's lawyer had raised his eyebrows when J.B. had told him to contact his lawyer, Jude St. Francis. "St. Francis?" asked the opposing lawyer. "How'd you get him?" He told Black Henry Young about this, who wasn't surprised. "Oh, yeah," he said. "Jude's known for being icy and vicious. He'll get it for you, J.B., don't worry." This had startled him. His Jude? Someone who literally hadn't been able to lift his head and look him in the eye until their sophomore year? Vicious? He simply couldn't imagine it. "I know," said Black Henry Young when he expressed his disbelief. "But he becomes someone else at work, J.B. I saw him in a court once, and he was borderline frightening, just incredibly relentless. If I hadn't known him, I'd have thought he was a giant asshole." But Black Henry Young had turned out to be right. He got his painting back, and not only that, but he got a letter of apology from the collector as well. And then, of course, there was Willem. The horrible, petty part of him had to admit that he had never, ever expected Willem to be as successful as he was. Not that he hadn't wanted it for him. He had just never thought it would happen. Willem, with his lack of competitive spirit, Willem with his deliberateness, Willem, who in college had turned down a starring role in Look Back in Anger to go tend to his sick brother. On the one hand, he had understood it, and on the other hand, his brother hadn't been fatally ill, not then. Even his own mother had told him not to come. He hadn't. Where once his friends had needed him, for color, for excitement, they no longer did. He didn't like to think of himself as someone who wanted his friends to be, well, not unsuccessful, but enthralled to him. But maybe he was. The thing he hadn't realized about success was that success made people boring. Failure also made people boring, but in a different way. Failing people were constantly striving for one thing, success. But successful people were also only striving to maintain their success. It was the difference between running and running in place. And although running was boring, no matter what, at least the person running was moving, through different scenery and past different vistas. And yet here again, it seemed that Jude and Willem had something he didn't, something that was protecting them from the suffocating ennui of being successful, from the tedium of waking up and realizing that you were a success, and that every day you had to keep doing whatever it was that made you a success, because once you stopped, you were no longer a success. You were becoming a failure. He sometimes thought that the real thing that distinguished him and Malcolm from Jude and Willem was not race or wealth, but Jude's and Willem's depthless capacity for wonderment. Their childhoods had been so paltry, so gray, compared to his, that it seemed they were constantly being dazzled as adults. The June after they graduated, the Irvines had gotten them all tickets to Paris, where, it emerged, they had an apartment. A tiny apartment, Malcolm had clarified, defensively, in the 7th. He had been to Paris with his mother in junior high, and again with his class in high school, and between his sophomore and junior years of college, but it wasn't until he had seen Jude's and Willem's faces that he was able to most vividly realize not just the beauty of the city, but its promise of enchantments. He envied this in them, this ability they had, though he realized that in Jude's case, at least, it was a reward for a long and punitive childhood. To still be awestruck, the faith they maintained that life, adulthood, would keep presenting them with astonishing experiences, that their marvelous years were not behind them. He remembered, too, watching them try uni for the first time, and their reactions, like they were Helen Keller and were just comprehending that that cool splash on their hands had a name and that they could know it, made him both impatient and intensely envious. What must it feel like to be an adult and still discovering the world's pleasures? And that, he sometimes felt, was why he loved being high so much. Not because it offered an escape from everyday life, as so many people thought, but because it made everyday life seem less everyday. For a brief period, briefer and briefer with each week, the world was splendid and unknown.
At other times, he wondered whether it was that the world had lost its color, or his friends themselves. When had everyone become so alike? Too often, it seemed that the last time people were so interesting had been college, grad school. And then they had, slowly but inevitably, become like everyone else. Take the members of Backfat. In school, they had marched topless, the three of them fat and luscious and jiggly, all the way down the Charles to protest cutbacks to Planned Parenthood. No one had been sure how the toplessness had been relevant, but whatever, and played amazing sets in the Hood Hall basement, and lit an effigy of an anti-feminist state senator on fire in the quad. But now Francesca and Marta were talking about having babies, and moving from their Bushwick loft into a Boreham Hill brownstone, and Edie was actually starting a business for real this time. And last year, when he'd suggested they stage a Backfat reunion, they had all laughed, although he hadn't been joking. His persistent nostalgia depressed him, aged him, and yet he couldn't stop feeling that the most glorious years, the years when everything seemed drawn in fluorescence, were gone. Everyone had been so much more entertaining then. What had happened? Age, he guessed, and with it, jobs, money, children, the things to forestall death, the things to ensure one's relevance, the things to comfort and provide context and content. The march forward, one dictated by biology and convention, that not even the most irreverent mind could withstand. But those were his peers. What he really wanted to know was when his friends had become so conventional, and why he hadn't noticed earlier. Malcolm had always been conventional, of course, but he had expected somehow more from Willem and Jude. He knew how awful this sounded, and so he never said it aloud. But he often thought that he had been cursed with a happy childhood. What if, instead, something actually interesting had happened to him? As it was, the only interesting thing that had happened to him was that he had attended a mostly white prep school, and that wasn't even interesting. Thank God he wasn't a writer, or he'd have had nothing to write about. And then there was someone like Jude, who hadn't grown up like everyone else, and didn't look like everyone else, and yet who J.B. knew was constantly trying to make himself exactly like everyone else. He would have taken Willem's looks, of course, but he would have killed something small and adorable to have looked like Jude, to have had a mysterious limp that was really more of a glide, and to have the face and body that he did. But Jude spent most of his time trying to stand still and look down, as if by doing so, no one would notice he existed. This had been sad and yet somewhat understandable in college, when Jude had been so childlike and bony that it made JB's joints hurt to look at him. But these days, now that he'd grown into his looks, JB found it simply enraging, especially as Jude's self-consciousness often interfered with his own plans. "Do you want to spend your life just being completely average and boring and typical?" he once asked Jude. This was during their second big fight, when he was trying to get Jude to pose nude, an argument he'd known even before he'd begun it that he had no chance at all of winning. "Yes, JB," Jude had said, giving him that gaze he sometimes summoned, which was intimidating, even slightly scary in its flat blankness. "That's in fact exactly what I want." Sometimes he suspected that all Jude really wanted to do in life was hang out in Cambridge with Harold and Julia and play house with them. Last year, for example, JB had been invited on a cruise by one of his collectors, a hugely wealthy and important patron who had a yacht that plied the Greek islands, and that was hung with modern masterpieces that any museum would have been happy to own, only they were installed in the bathroom of a boat. Malcolm had been working on his project in Doha, or somewhere, but Willem and Jude had been in town, and he'd called Jude and asked him if he wanted to go. The collector would pay their way. He would send his plane. It would be 5 days on a yacht. He didn't know why he even needed to have a conversation. "Meet me at Teterboro," he should have just texted them. "Bring sunscreen." But no, he had asked, and Jude had thanked him. And then Jude had said, "But that's over Thanksgiving." "So?" he'd asked. "J.B., thank you so much for inviting me," Jude had said, as he listened in disbelief. "It sounds incredible, but I have to go to Harold and Julia's." He had been gobsmacked by this. Of course, he too was very fond of Harold and Julia, and like the others, he too could see how good they were for Jude, and how he'd become slightly less haunted with their friendship. But come on, it was Boston. He could always see them. But Jude said no, and that was that. And then, of course, because Jude said no, Willem had said no as well, and in the end, he had ended up with the two of them and Malcolm in Boston, seething at the scene around the table. Parental stand-ins, friends of the parental stand-ins, lots of mediocre food, liberals having arguments with one another about democratic politics that involved a lot of shouting about issues they all agreed on. That was so cliched and generic that he wanted to scream, and yet held such bizarre fascination for Jude and Willem. So which had come first, becoming close to Jackson, or realizing how boring his friends were? He had met Jackson after the opening of his second show, which had come almost 5 years after his first. The show was called Everyone I've Ever Known, Everyone I've Ever Loved, Everyone I've Ever Hated, Everyone I've Ever Fucked, and was exactly that. 150 15-by-20 2-inch paintings on thin pieces of board of the faces of everyone he had ever known. The series had been inspired by a painting he had done of Jude and given to Harold and Julia on the day of Jude's adoption. God, he loved that painting. He should have just kept it. Or he should have exchanged it. Harold and Julia would have been happy with a less superior piece, as long as it was of Jude. The last time he had been in Cambridge, he had seriously considered stealing it, slipping it off its hook in the hallway, and stuffing it into his duffel bag before he left. Once again, Everyone I've Ever Known was a success, although it hadn't been the series he had wanted to do. The series he had wanted to do was the series he was working on now. Jackson was another of the gallery's artists, and although J.B. had known of him, he had never actually met him before, and was surprised, after being introduced to him at the dinner after the opening, how much he had liked him, how unexpectedly funny he was, because Jackson was not the type of person he'd normally gravitate toward. For one thing, he hated, really hated Jackson's work. He made found sculptures, but of the most puerile and obvious sort, like a Barbie doll's legs glued to the bottom of a can of tuna fish. Oh, God, he'd thought, the first time he'd seen that on the gallery's website. He's being represented by the same gallery as I am? He didn't even consider it art. He considered it provocation, although only a high school student, no, a junior high student, would consider it provocative. Jackson thought the pieces Keenholtzian, which offended J.B., and he didn't even like Keenholtz. For another, Jackson was rich, so rich that he had never worked a single day in his life, so rich that his gallerist had agreed to represent him, or so everyone said, and God, he hoped it was true, as a favor to Jackson's father. So rich that his shows sold out because, it was rumored, his mother, who had divorced Jackson's father, a manufacturer of some sort of essential widget of airplane machinery, when Jackson was young and married an inventor of some sort of essential widget of heart transplant surgeries, bought out all his shows and then auctioned the pieces, driving up the prices, and then buying them back, inflating Jackson's sales record. Unlike other rich people he knew, including Malcolm and Richard and Ezra, Jackson only rarely pretended not to be rich. J.B. had always found the others' parsimoniousness put on and irritating. But seeing Jackson once smack down $100 bill for 2 candy bars when they were both high and giggly and starving at 3 in the morning, telling the cashier to keep the change, had sobered him. There was something obscene about how careless Jackson was with money, something that reminded J.B. that, as much as he thought of himself otherwise, he too was boring and conventional, and his mother's son. For a third, Jackson wasn't even good-looking. He supposed he was straight. At any rate, there were always girls around, girls whom Jackson treated disdainfully, and yet who drifted after him, limp-like, their faces smooth and empty. But he was the least sexy person J.B. had ever met. Jackson had very pale hair, almost white, and pimple-stippled skin, and teeth that were clearly once expensive-looking, but had gone the color of dust, and whose gaps were grouted with butter-yellow tartar, the sight of which repulsed J.B. His friends hated Jackson, and as it became clear that Jackson and his own group of friends, lonely rich girls like Hera and sort of artists like Massimo and alleged art writers like Zane, many of them Jackson's classmates from the loser day school he'd gone to after failing out of every other private school in New York, including the one that J.B. had attended, were in his life to stay, they all tried to talk to him about Jackson. "You're always going on about what a phony Ezra is," Willem had said. "But how exactly is Jackson any different than Ezra, other than being a total fucking asshole?" And Jackson was an asshole, and around him J.B. was an asshole as well. A few months ago, the fourth or fifth time he'd tried to stop doing drugs, he had called Jude one day. It was 5 in the afternoon, and he'd just woken up, and he felt so awful, so incredibly old and exhausted and just done, his skin slimy, his teeth furry, his eyes dry as wood, that he had wanted, for the first time, to be dead, to simply not have to keep going on and on and on. "Something has to change," he told himself. "I have to stop hanging around with Jackson. I have to stop. Everything has to stop." He missed his friends. He missed how innocent and clean they were. He missed being the most interesting among them. He missed never having to try around them. So he had called Jude. Naturally, Willem wasn't fucking in town, and Malcolm couldn't be trusted not to freak out, and asked him, begged him, to come over after work. He told him where, exactly, the rest of the crystal was, under the loose half-plank of wood under the right side of the bed, and where his pipe was, and asked him to flush it down the toilet, to get rid of it all. "J.B., Jude had said, "listen to me. Go to that cafe on Clinton, okay? Take your sketch pad. Get yourself something to eat. I'm coming down as soon as I can, as soon as this meeting's over. And then I'll text you when I'm done and you can come home, all right?" "Okay," he'd said. And he'd stood up and taken a very long shower, hardly scrubbing himself, just standing under the water, and then had done exactly what Jude had instructed. He picked up his sketch pad and pencils. He went to the cafe. He ate some of a chicken club sandwich and drank some coffee. And he waited. And while he was waiting, he saw, passing the window like a bipedal mongoose with his dirty hair and delicate chin, Jackson. He watched Jackson walk by, his self-satisfied rich boy lope, that pleased half-smile on his face that made J.B. want to hit him, as detached as if Jackson was just someone ugly he saw on the street, not someone ugly he saw almost every day. And then, just before he passed out of sight, Jackson turned and looked in the window, directly at him, and smiled his ugly smile, and reversed direction, and walked back toward the cafe and through the door, as if he had known all along that J.B. was there, as if he had materialized only to remind J.B. that J.B. was his now, that there would be no escaping from him, that J.B. was there to do what Jackson wanted him to do when Jackson wanted him to do it, and that his life would never be his own again. For the first time, he had been scared of Jackson, had panicked. "What has happened?" he wondered. He was Jean-Baptiste Marion. He made the plans. People followed him, not the other way around. Jackson would never let him go, he realized, and he was frightened. He was someone else's. He was owned now. How would he ever become unowned? How could he ever return to who he was? "Sup," said Jackson, unsurprised to see him, as unsurprised as if he had willed J.B. into being. What could he say? "Sup," he said. Then his phone rang. Jude, telling him that all was safe, and he could come back.